I'm Nick Harvey Doyle, an Anawan man from the northern tablelands of New South Wales. The Yarn podcast is made on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung, and Bunurong people. We'd like to acknowledge First Nations people as the first storytellers. We pay our respects to elders past and present. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land.
From the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne, this is The Yarn. I'm Thomas Phillips. Ask a group of teenagers about their dream jobs and you'll likely hear a familiar list. Doctor, lawyer, architect, psychologist. According to an OECD survey, these are some of the most desired jobs among students worldwide. But what about all the jobs they don't even know exist? This week, we're bringing you stories from off the beaten career path. Stories about people along the number 19 tram line finding fulfillment in unconventional workplaces. It's the second episode of Tram Tales, our new series about Melburnians who live, work, and travel along the number 19 route, the city's central artery. First up, a story from stop number 13, Cemetery Road. Sam Irvine interviews Michelle Chekin, whose clients include the living and the dead. She's the customer care consultant of Melbourne Cemetery.
So my role is predominantly to help families when someone has passed away, to help them select a position for their loved ones, also to help people who are pre-planning, who want to, you know, secure a position at our cemetery. I also assist with upkeeping the records, helping with historical records, helping families that are looking for, you know, long-lost loved ones. So all sorts of things here.
Can you tell me a little bit about the history of the cemetery?
So Melbourne General opened back in 1853 and it has been in operation ever since. There's so many important people in Melbourne's history that are interred here, from prime ministers to gangsters to, you know, people that developed, you know, the eight-hour working day movement in Melbourne, you know, lots of famous people here.
As we drove into the cemetery, we saw the shrine to Elvis. Could you tell me a little bit about the Elvis shrine?
Absolutely. So the Elvis shrine is probably still one of the most visited monuments at the Melbourne Cemetery. So it was erected not long after his death, and it's the only one in the Southern Hemisphere that has been approved by his father. So it's, very visited. It's beautiful.
So aside from your position at the cemetery, what is your personal connection to this place?
So my personal connection is that I was born in Carlton. I still live in Carlton now. And I have very fond memories of walking through the cemetery when I was a child to go visit my grandmother, who was living at the time. So, of course, walking through the cemetery to get to her house. We used to come here on school excursions with big pieces of butcher paper and charcoal, and we used to take rubbings of the gravestones. We used to also come through here and pick the daisies and make daisy chains. You know, now I work here, which is wonderful. So yeah, it's a really important part of my childhood growing up, and it's also a really important part of a lot of Victorians' history.
What is it, do you think, that makes it so special for so many people?
Oh, I think a lot of things. I think that given that it is one of the oldest, I think also given that in my time working here, I've come to the understanding that cemeteries are more for the living than they are for the dead. You know, it's a place for people to connect. It's a place for people to reflect, especially at this cemetery here. We have a lot of school groups coming through, learning about the history of Melbourne, history of Victoria. People, of course, obviously visiting loved ones that have passed recently. You know, they form friendships with other people who have an understanding of what they're going through. So yeah, I think it's really important for a lot of Victorians.
It does feel very under the radar, and not a lot of people, at least I think, would feel the need to come in here. Do you think for the people who hold this place dearest, that's what's so special about it?
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things that I hear the most is, as you said to me before, Sam, was I've driven past the cemetery so many times that I've never come in, or I live around the cemetery and I've never walked through it. And, you know, it's right in the middle of the city and it's so strange that it's right here. And yeah, I think one thing I can say to people is just don't be afraid, you know, come on in, learn about the history, read some of these headstones because they're amazing. You know, it tells the tales of people's lives, and they didn't have Facebook back in the day. So everything about their lives is strewed on their headstones. It's an amazing place.
That was Michelle Chekin talking to Sam Irvine. Our next story is from stop number 3, Bourke Street Mall. Long Fei Zhou chats to Paige Obort, the co-owner of a more inclusive adult store called High Tide. The store aims to create a safe and welcoming environment for everyone.
High Tide is a modern adult store located on Rankin's Lane in Nam. It doesn't categorize by gender. You're able to always like speak and form a relationship with the person working, but it just became very guest-centric as opposed to trying to sell product. Looking at sex in a holistic perspective of mind, body, all of those kinds of things, it feels quite progressive still. And a lot of it is like steeped in a lot of like patriarchy.
You encounter some like, you know, difficulties, including resistance from some people. What do you think of these?
The day before we were set to open, we found out that we had objections from neighbors. There would be people that were bristled by the idea of having an adult store on their laneway when all they had was a preconceived notion of what an adult store would look like. It was a little bit disappointing. We had written letters to everyone. We'd sent photos and mood boards, but no one really wanted to engage with us or have a conversation with us. And a very small minority rallied quite hard, communicated with the council, which essentially put a halt on everything. Originally, we were meant to open and then we got told no. From that ensued several months back and forth where we essentially had to wait to present in front of the Lord Mayor, where we had to essentially put forward our case. But because of bureaucracy, it took 5 months. So that was 5 months of paying rent without a shop being open, 5 months of being very, very unsure. But also truly a positive thing was that so many people rallied. That was probably the biggest hurdle that we went through.
Why do you think High Tide contributes to develop women's health, gender and sexuality?
I think High Tide helps or contributes to like a positive change because we are all at different points in our lives, whether that is through age, through experience, through relationships with religion, relationships with social structures. Everyone is on this journey, but we still sit, the people that we're talking to and the women specifically that we're talking to kind of sit within this ether of discovering themselves and wanting to learn about themselves, have grown up or been institutionalized by messaging that says, you know, sex is performative. You are there to make a male partner feel good and you are supplementary to that. So there is a lot of undoing around that. And High Tide really tries to center that. It's not the be all and end all. It's not to define you and there is no pressure. We try to approach it in a very shame-free, guilt-free way. It's not a bad thing that you want to feel good in your body.
Do you have any like long-term prospects?
We envision that we would have different stores within the city, different identities. There'll never be another High Tide, but would love to grow our online store so that that can really encompass a much wider range of products. And then we'd love to continue to grow our events offering. And then one day in the future, when we figure out how to do it correctly, we'd love to have our own label within that.
That was Paige Obort talking to Longfei Zhou. Our third story is about the complete rejection of career paths. Ellen Cutler interviews Emily Spratt, who found herself living among a group of homeless vagabonds while traveling abroad. These days, Emily lives a more settled life near Route 19, but she opened up to Ellen about her former life on society's outskirts.
When I was 19, I was traveling in Europe. Didn't have very much money. I'd gone with not very much money. So I was couch surfing in a town called Nerja in the south of Spain. I ended up having a problem with my couch surfing host there and I had to leave in the middle of the night and I bumped into a group of travelers, I suppose you could call them. They preferred to call themselves vagabonds. Just sort of travelers who slept outside, abstained from society or whatever, but I ended up asking if I could stay with them. And that night I slept on the beach and met my first boyfriend ever, a Polish guy called Teo. And what followed was a bit of a whirlwind. I ended up traveling with him all through Europe. We slept in caves, on the beaches, on the streets. I had a crazy time. Bought a car that I couldn't afford that broke down 2 weeks later. We adopted a dog. And then I eventually had to leave because I had to go back to see my family. And I just knew I'd never see him again. After I left Teo in the wintertime, I went back to Nerja because I had stashed my laptop there. But when I went back in winter, I realized that this community and this lifestyle had started to break apart. because it was the first time I'd really been confronted with the fact that they didn't have anywhere else to go and it wasn't a choice.
And would you recommend that young people do something similar, or you think it's something that they should try and skip if they can?
I wouldn't recommend it. I would recommend finding something more wholesome, more safe, and just more honest. I don't think it was a very honest experience for me or for anybody that I met. I don't know.
So you think that you were more playing into a character than being your true self throughout that experience?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it was. I was becoming a character because I was obsessed with reading and books, and I grew up in rural Tasmania, and so I just wanted to experience something crazy. But again, I think it was just so self-indulgent. Even the fact that I started with a pseudonym. When Teo first got a glance at my credit card, he assumed that I'd stolen it because it had my real name on it and not that that was my actual name. You know what? I did become a character. And I think that I was so lost at the end of that experience, even though I thought, oh, without the shackles, I'm becoming my true self. It's not true. I was just becoming a character I was writing for myself.
That was Emily Pratt talking to Ellen Cutler. Our final story is from stop number 7, the old Melbourne jail. Construction began in the 1840s, and it's the site where 133 people were hanged, including the infamous bushranger Ned Kelly. Fan Ting Meng interviews tour guide Dr. Luigi Socho about some of the most notorious prisoners detained there. Just a heads up, this story contains a description of a violent knife crime.
The worst prison story I have heard was a 14-year-old boy called James Gribble. In 1957, he was sentenced to an indeterminate sentence because he murdered his 17-year-old sister for using his bicycle. He stabbed her 48 times. It was a terrible story. He obviously had some mental issues. He tried to escape in 1957. He tried to climb a wall and he got halfway up the wall and a guard saw him and fired two warning shots. He still kept climbing, so the guard killed him, shot him and killed him. So he was a 14-year-old boy, obviously had mental health problems, and he was killed.
So, how about the Chopper?
Chopper Reed, he was a very famous criminal. There was a movie made a few years ago called Chopper. Chopper was just terrible. He just committed so many crimes. And he spent time in H Division here, but he had his own gang in prison. And so there would be a lot of fights with his gang and other groups in the prison. And as I said, he worked in the kitchen here in H Division and he wanted revenge because he had a lot of enemies. So he would prepare this vegetable curry and he would put something in it. Then the next day, all the prisoners would be sick.
That was Dr. Luigi Socho talking to Fan Ting Meng. A massive thank you to producers Sam Irvine, Longfei Zhou, Ellen Cutler, and Fan Ting Meng. The yarn is from the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne. It's produced on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Our executive producer is Louisa Lim. I'm Thomas Phillips. See you next week.